Hi, I'm Danny.
And I'm Gabby.
And this is Clashes, a podcast exploring culture shock in all its chaotic forms.
We know a good shock can shake things up.
So we blew up our lives and crash landed in Paris.
With a delusional sense of hope.
And a dangerous bread habit.
I feel attacked. But culture shock isn't just about changing countries.
Almost. It's about embracing the unknown.
From navigating friendships in your 30s.
Awkward. To processing pop culture's oddest obsessions.
So buckle up and embrace the chaos.
One clash at a time.
All right, guys.
Are we back?
We're on.
Okay. I never know when we're starting because we're always talking shit behind the scenes.
Always talking shit. Today's a very, very, very exciting day.
I know. So we have our first ever guest on the pod. I mean Gabby, figured out how to connect the third mic that we bought a month ago.
Well, you guys are going to give us feedback on that because it could be fucked up.
No, it'll be fine. Very well fucked up. So we're very happy to have our friend Matt Ortile on the podcast today.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Matt.
Matt is an editor and writer at Condé Nast Traveler, an author, which like, holy shit. The dream to call yourself an author, and also just generally a professional Paris lover,
a professional traveler too.
Yes. He's a really good Instagram follow.
Yes, yeah. He's always on a plane or like on a fancy lounge somewhere or like on an exotic location.
Do you ever meet cool people in the lounge? I'm derailing the conversation.
You know, I haven't actually kind of like met someone and stayed in touch with them.
Okay,
I've had like some interesting one-off conversations, and in the way that you know, you like. In the way that why we travel, you know, it's like it's fun to just kind of meet random strangers and have a really, you know, fleeting but meaningful or like genuine connection. And then you just kind of hold out to tuck that into your pocket.
I love that though. It's like dream stranger energy. Yeah. I feel like something
stranger
about
energy.
Being, it's so good in the specific, when I moved to Paris, they like forced me to basically get a first class ticket. They're like, you can't take 45 bags on the plane with like your plebeian ticket.
Oh, right.
And so I had
so
to take it. And I, Matt, was like best friends with everyone in the
really?
Lounge.
Really?
There
because
you go.
I think everyone's like, well, you're in not a good like mood. A poor rando.
Yeah.
Like everyone in there is like,
you're one of us.
Level.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a bit of a club. It's clubby.
It was. I was like waving to people as they were walking down the aisles. I had like knew everyone's name. So anyway, I'm very jealous every time I see you because back in the coach, we all hate each other.
Yeah, it's miserable there.
Well, you know what they say in Bridesmaids, right? Like she'll have a much better time in coach. There's much more of a sense of community.
It's not true. There's no sense of community. I did have to, I had to travel business when I moved here because I had 75 bags. Mm. But also that's when I was a pseudo influencer and I was working with Air France and it was COVID time. So they were like, we're going to upgrade you. And I was like, because, yeah, the plane was empty.
It's empty.
And I was like, that was still a nice gesture,
though.
It is
still nice. Totally. Sometimes they won't.
And I was like, I could never go back to coach after this.
Yeah.
But then my bank account was like, you sure can.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it must be nice. Also, like, stranger energy in the air. When you're in the airport, it's like you're a different person. Also, 100%. When you're, like, in travel mode, you're just like,
yeah.
I could be anyone.
There was a TikTok the other day, and it was like, I had my friend film me while I was at the airport to see if I looked cool and mysterious.
Did they? Did they look
she
cool and mysterious?
She actually did look cool and mysterious.
Amazing. So everybody's hotter at the airport, I feel.
So. Yeah. You're like, who are they? Where are they going?
Who are they?
One
yeah.
man on my plane. Like, uh-huh. He's my for sure future husband.
Yeah.
Every single time.
That is I would love, like, that's a great story of, like, how you met your husband or your partner or whatever. It's like, oh, we were just on the plane together and we just hit it off.
I remember one of my very, very first trips to Paris. Maybe it was, like, my third or so. I was flying back. It was back when, I don't know if you guys know about the British Airways Open Skies kind of route. It was a direct route between Orly and JFK. And it was this thing that's been canceled since before the pandemic.
Is there any flights to the U.S. from Orly at this point?
Yeah, French B.
Yeah. Our good friend Preeti Gills does
flight. Yeah, yeah. My mom's actually taken it for the first time.
There
this
you
summer.
Go.
So let's see. I'll report back.
Yeah. It's like a value airline, but it's a good value proposition. But I remember, I bring that part up the open skies because like these were like smaller planes, like normally used for like regional flights. I would say it's like single aisle, so it's kind of like an intimate plane.
Yeah,
right?
That reminds me of like the old fashioned photos of planes.
Kind of because it was like actually cushy seats, and then it was just. It wasn't a bulkhead. It wasn't a wall that separated the upfront cabin from the back. It was fully just a curtain. But anyway, I was seated right behind the curtain, and it was three and three. So three aisle, three seats. I was on one side. I was sitting on the aisle. I'm an aisle person. Because I hate disturbing people to get up to pee.
Same.
True.
And
but then
like
I'm disturbed
times.
When they get up to pee.
Right, of course.
So I'm sitting in the aisle. There's a handsome Frenchman in the window seat. And then I was looking at the middle seat and I said something like, do you think someone's going to sit there? And he says, I hope not. Do you want to?
No.
I was like,
are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you.
Do you love me?
I was like, oh, this is it. It's my time. And
I love how we all think like we have our time. Like,
this is it. Will be a moment. It's finally happening. Like
it's when you're traveling, you're the main character.
Yeah.
So always. Just, I think that's what it is.
What like, did you
that
do?
People carry themselves with a sense of main character energy. So it went over my head that his line, and I was like, I was like, wait.
You're like, wait. Are we
should I? Should I move over? I did not. But we did just keep talking, and like, you know, he lived in the U.S. I don't know if he's still there. He lived in New York, and we just had a lovely, lovely conversation. And then we were being served lunch. We were talking. We were having wine. It was like lovely first date. And then he brings up his husband.
No.
But then I realized, like, that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, right. It's an open marriage.
2025.
Could be open marriage, exactly. Or it could be falling apart. Yeah. But
or
then
it doesn't count if we're in the sky, kind of.
Yeah, exactly. Right. International. It's international like with maritime law, right?
I love that. You know how like open relationships have so many rules. Yeah. It's like that's one. It's like you can only
hook up with people while you're traveling. Yeah.
Only Mile High Club. But it was. I shut down after that. I just ended up watching that Anne Hathaway, Jason Sudeikis movie. I think it's Catastrophe or whatever it's called. It's such a deep cut. It's weird.
That feels like an airplane movie.
Fully, yeah. And it was. And then I never saw him again.
Okay. Yeah. But it's so romantic. Like we say, stranger energy.
It was stranger energy. Yeah. And I feel like this is the thing about travel. You're just that much more open to everything, right? Yeah. Like every possible experience. You say yes more, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's why it's sometimes hard when you travel with people who are not, who don't have that energy.
Yeah, because I think not everyone is that way. But you have to find people who also have that, like, yes, travel energy.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's very cool. Yeah.
How do you identify as a yes travel person?
So my dad, when we were young, used to do this thing. Have I told you this? I don't know. He would, like, hold our shoulders before we went on a vacation. And he would be like, okay, guys. And he would shake our shoulders. And he'd be like, you're in adventure mode now.
Oh, I love.
And his whole premise was, like, once you step out the door, like, everything is free.
Anything can happen.
Adventure.
Yeah.
So, like, it's not an irritant. It's not something going wrong. It's, like, a challenge, part of a mission, or whatever.
That's a really good thing.
I always try to think that way when I...
That's a great thing to tell to kids, especially. Because kids could be very fussy when they travel. So, if you're, like, this is a game or, like, you're in an adventure.
Right, like, flight canceled, flight delayed. Yeah. Like, now we, like, roam the airport.
I'm going to tell that to myself when I travel.
Honestly, it puts you in a higher tolerance of, like, this is not how I'm used to things. This is not what I'm accustomed to. And so by, you know, like framing the unfamiliar as an adventure, as something exciting, as something as you want to pursue.
Yeah.
It opens you up so much more and like helps you just kind of be more adaptable.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's like, oh, when your baggage is lost, it's like, okay, this is an adventure. God damn it. Like,
right. Yeah. It is. I think it's helpful.
No, I agree.
Yeah. Agreed.
Anyways, let's go. I know this, Matt, you know the premise of the podcast. So it's about culture clashes. Mm-hmm. And we thought we would start off by asking you, I mean, you and Danny have similar backgrounds around like growing up in a different country, moving to the U.S. So I wanted to hear a little bit more about that specific experience. Like what was that initial move like? Was it what you expected? I'm always curious, like the very first like culture clash moment in your life.
Yeah, what like when did you move to the U.S.? Like, tell us a little bit about your background growing up, where you're from and everything, and then we'll get into it.
Yeah.
So I was born in the Philippines. I was born in Manila, the capital, and I was always very much a city boy. And I was already visiting the U.S. ever since I was 2 years old. My mother's parents were based in San Francisco until they passed in, you know, the 2010s. And I would visit my grandparents in San Francisco. I think every 2 years, was it? So as I grew up, you know, I always had a little bit of piece of America. Like, we'd stay for a month and, like, you know, I knew what Costco was, you know.
Shut up.
Things like that.
Did you like it when you, like, when's the first
time?
Yeah, you did.
Love,
yeah, what was your, like, favorite place to go?
Costco.
Honestly,
mine
kind
was
of.
Publix, so.
Fully. I like, the whole joke was that whenever we did go to Costco to, like, buy things that we couldn't in the Philippines at the time. I mean, now trade is so global. Right. That, like, you know. I think we may even have a Costco or like a Costco franchise. I don't know. It might be possible. But, you know, we would buy things and like bring it all back home to like, you know, we'd have these things called balikbayan boxes, which literally means like return country boxes. Like this is a big Filipino tradition. You buy like huge like moving boxes essentially and you stuff them with all the imported goods that you can bring back home. or your family abroad will send you like buy-in boxes. So it's like every, you know, every year we would get a big like buy-in box from my grandparents from San Francisco. Oh, cool. I'd be at home in Manila being like, oh, what did grandma and Lola get me? It was so very cool. Christmas. It's Christmas, big Christmas energy. And I'd be like, Nesquik, you know, like with that brown rabbit on. Yeah. I forget his name.
Yeah.
But I forgot his name.
Yeah. It was not Bugs Bunny, but you know. But I remember, you know, we made actually had a family joke about Costco because my grandmother, God bless her, God, what a bitch. I love you.
May she rest in peace.
May she rest in peace. No, my mom and her had a pretty tough relationship, but, you know, ultimately she was not threatening, but she was such a character and such a, she was so brat. She was brat before
she was brat. Brat summering like, before it was a thing.
Brat. And the first definition in Merriam-Webster, brat, B-R-A-T. And she was like, kind of like very, not stern. She was just like kind of spoiled, very childish. But it was so funny because the only time she was ever really happy would be at Costco when she'd try all the samples.
Oh my God.
I mean, girl, same.
And I'd be like, wait, where did she go?
And sample then you're seeing culture her. Yeah. In the US also like blew my mind. Like going to the mall and like the food court and just being able to like have a full meal based on samples.
Yeah. And yet not buy anything because you just went to every incredible. Oh my God,
as a
one.
Kid, we used to do this thing at Sam's Club. Remember Sam's Club?
Sam's Club.
And we sisters and I would try to see how many times we could go back to the same one. We would like try to put on disguises. Put like,
yeah. There's that meme, you know, that meme, like every time I'm trying to get samples, different wigs. Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, it's okay. That's what you remember most.
Very
Costco.
Much so, like growing up. And like, so to that point, like by the time that I moved to the States when I was 11 years old, it was not a total culture shock for me. Like I had been kind of sampling, getting samples of American culture. Yeah.
Wait, where did you move when you moved?
Totally. So I thought we were moving to San Francisco, which was I was very excited about. Like as a young 11-year-old kid who's like starting to learn a little bit about like just different from other boys and hearing like whispers about the Castro in San Francisco. It's like, oh, there is kinship here with like how I feel as a person and me. This will be really exciting for me. But we just landed with my grandparents in San Francisco for like a month and then moved actually to Las Vegas where my mom's brother was living and so we spent our first full year in America living with him and then we got our own place.
And how was that experience living in Vegas? Did you grow up in Vegas?
Yeah, I did middle school and high school there, so from like 6th to 12th grade.
I literally know so little about Vegas. I'm like just picturing like stripper poles and like the middle school.
Matt at the casino at 10 years old.
Honestly, yeah. Like my mom, when we first got there, my mom worked at pharmaceuticals and eventually she got a job at Pfizer, which now everybody knows what Pfizer is ever since COVID. But to first like get us on our feet, my mom, God bless her, worked like maybe for 5-6 months at Ann Taylor.
Oh.
She worked retail at the Venetian shops, at the Venetian Hotel.
Oh, no way.
The Grand Canal shops
probably,
at
like,
the Venetian.
Had like some nice people coming into that, no?
I mean, like she made a lot on commission.
Yeah, people are dropping money there, I'm sure.
100%. And what was hilarious was that my mom didn't have childcare because my uncle also worked. He worked at the Rockport at, you know, the shoe shop. He worked at in the Venetian as well. So they couldn't leave me at home. So they would like, okay, well, he's coming to the Venetian
with
us.
This is where your sense of style started?
I guess so. The Venetian Grand Canal shops. But at a certain point, I couldn't just like hang out at the Ann Taylor, like the whole, my mom's entire shift.
Right.
So she'd be like, okay, go out, explore, like have, you know, just.
How old were you?
I was 11 when this
was kind of like 11 every 11-year-old's dream to be like wandering through like the mall or no?
Just the mall. It was the mall, but it was also not any regular mall. It was a mall that was made to look like the Grand Canal in Venice. Like, you know, like if you've ever been to Las Vegas, the trick about these places is that they really eliminate time from the space.
Yeah, you don't know if it's day or night.
I don't know if it's day or night. It's always like perpetual, like late afternoon, just about to be about sunset. You're in the quote unquote Piazza San Marco in the Venetian Grand Canal shops. And they have opera singers, you know, so like they'll put on performances like every 30 minutes, you know.
But that's kind of cool.
The whole thing about Vegas is that it's Disneyland and it's all fake and you're there because it's fake.
So I wasn't that far off. I've
never been, but that's exactly what I picture.
Yeah. And so like I got to know like the There's the gondoliers. Yeah, the gondolieri. Are you kidding? Yeah, yeah, yeah. They would have gondola rides in this mall.
You don't have to go to Europe to experience Venice.
So this basically defines sense of style, your first European experience.
The more that I thought about this, because like travel weirdly and being a travel editor at Condé Nast Traveler, it kind of came in very late into my life and very much by accident. But when I look back, there were so many signs that pointed to kind of this point in my life.
Right.
Like, I was introduced to travel by my mother, like as an immigrant, like my mom was the one to bring me over, you know, like hotels were a big part of my life because I grew up in Vegas. You know, like Europe, like facsimiles and like imitations of Europe, you know, there's the Venetian, there's the Bellagio, you know, like Lago di Como.
Yeah.
Or the Paris hotel where, you know,
the fake Eiffel Tower.
The fake Eiffel Tower. And it's all there. But I think as a kid, I didn't love growing up in Vegas. I was very conscious that it was all artifice. It was all counterfeit. Okay. It was all imitation. And so I talk a lot about this in the book. I really just wanted reality. I wanted New York. But at the time, living in Las Vegas, I just knew I wanted something that felt more real.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate the word authentic, but I wanted authenticity.
Right.
And so now living in New York, traveling a lot in Europe and in Asia, it's now kind of, I mean, we can get into this more later, but it was almost kismet. I never realized that my life actually has this somewhat coherent story, or I've kind of thought about it enough to like put together a story that makes sense to me.
Like in hindsight.
There's a theme there. Also, like, there's not a lot of 11-year-olds that know what the Venice canals are or what a gondolier is. So the fact that you were exposed to, like, even if it was like the Vegas version to that culture early on, I think it's definitely altered something.
You're like, is this an original thing? And then they're like, well, it's meant to be like X, Y, and Z. And then you understand that there is a source material.
Right.
Do you remember when your first, like, when you, obviously that was its own form of, like, culture clash moving to the U.S. Do you remember the first time you got to travel for, like, of your own free will? Like, your first,
So, it was interesting. I actually didn't travel a lot as a kid, funnily enough. Anytime I had school vacation or, you know, time to leave my home to go somewhere else, I went to my other home. I went back to the Philippines very often. And as I got older and met other Filipino Americans, I realized that was not actually something that they did. A lot of my Filipino American friends in New York are first gen, and I like to identify as immigrant. I feel like first generation, for my definition, personal definition, is first generation born in the place you moved
to. Yeah, I agree, yeah.
Right.
I'm the same.
You identify as immigrant.
I moved when I was 10.
Exactly.
I was immigrating. I wasn't born there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, totally.
Yeah. Like, we had lives before America.
Yeah. And I remember my life and my culture before that.
Totally.
That I spent more of my lifetime in the United States. It's a different story, but I had a life at this other place at one point.
Whereas, like, I feel like our first gen friends,
they were born there. Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't have that concrete connection to quote unquote motherland. And so for me, I had to maintain that. And like, the family context is that I moved with my mom to the U.S. My birth father stayed in Manila. And so to maintain a relationship with my birth father, I would visit every year, every summer vacation. And I spent pretty much the whole time there, like a month, 2 months in Manila to be with my family, cousins, etc.
When you were a kid, did you appreciate those trips, or was it like annoying that you had to go back? Because I felt that was annoying.
It was annoying. It was absolutely annoying. I felt like especially as I got into high school, I felt like I was coming into my own as a Filipino American, as an American, as a gay person, as a queer person. Going back felt like regressing into that 11-year-old that I'm eternally seen as by my father, by my grandmother. Right. And so it felt like an early draft of the book, my first book, The Groom Will Keep His Name.
You can find it in Paris, by the way, at Shakespeare
and Company. Yeah. A friend of mine once bought it there. It was really cool to see like the Shakespeare and Company stamp in the book. It was surreal.
Made it.
But I remember in an early draft of the book, I talked about how visiting the Philippines was like visiting a life fossilized in amber that never changed. And no one in my family changed. No one was growing up. Like, the adults were not changing. Of course not. But to me, it felt like, why would I ever like go back to my past. Whereas in contrast, now a lot of my Filipino American friends as adults, they're like, I'm so sad I don't have that connection. I'm so sad that my parents never let me learn the language because they were afraid that it would like confuse me, that my English would be poor because of it. And it's like, now I realize what a privilege it was to go home so often and to still call it home. Now I go every Christmas, but that meant the time that I had to travel was always just to this one place that I had familiarity with. I never got to experience new to me cultures until I was an adult.
Do you appreciate it now when you go back?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I felt the same way. I mean, I haven't gone back in like 10 years, but when I was like, when I was younger, I was like, this is so annoying. Why do we have to go back to this place? Mm. And now I'm like, damn, I wish I could go back. So yeah, it's funny how like your perspective changes when you're a kid, especially when you're trying to like integrate into this new culture, mm-hmm. this American culture. And you're like, let me be American. Why do I have to go back to this place?
Yes.
But I just wanted to see if you had the same perspective. So totally. I think
we're on very similar pages.
Yeah. Mm. So my next question is around culture shock. And specifically, do you remember your first instance of culture shock or when someone made a comment or said something about yourself that made you realize, oh, wait, maybe I'm not American or maybe I'm a little different than these other people? Do you remember what that was?
Yeah. I mean, of course it happened in school, right? As I said, because I grew up visiting America, I felt like I had a familiarity with it. And it wasn't such a big shock to my personality, to anything, to my experience ever since I moved to Vegas. But I was at school. I remember this always so clearly. I forget what the context was, but I was talking to someone about like accents, even like at that age, we were having conversations about accents. I mean, I grew up in a pretty diverse community. It was like pretty Mexican and Black, not a lot of Asians. And, you know, we had some white folks. But I was talking to someone and they said to me, like, you have an accent, Matt. I was like, and I can repeat this now. Like, I don't have this accent anymore, but I can put it on. And I literally went, I don't have an accent, you know, and it's like, it was truly fully like, kind of gobsmacked by that because in the Philippines, my English was better than my Filipino, right, to be honest. And like, my grades were higher in English classes than in Filipino classes.
Oh, wow.
And so to be confronted with that, to be fully reminded, like at that age, actually, no, you're not, you're apart,
right,
you're separate, you're other, you're mm-hmm. other. And so it really pushed me to actually really, really scrub it. Like, yeah. Again, I talk about this in the book. I, you know, really would practice my T's and V's rather than making
I was going
to
say, you enunciate so well.
Thanks.
It's just incredible. I don't know.
Yeah. It's interesting because I don't know what came first, whether that kind of subconscious, like really practicing versus I also grew up performing. I was a theater major in high school. I went to like the LaGuardia of Las Vegas. It's called Las Vegas Academy.
I didn't know this.
Yeah.
What was your favorite role?
Oh yeah. Favorite role. Honestly, West Side Story was fun. Mm. It was my senior year musical. One of two musicals that we did that year. And I was obviously a shark.
obviously.
I was so funny. I was up for Bernardo.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like really practicing to be straight. But the year before, I lost the director's trust. We did The Wiz. It's such a long story. We did The Wiz. I was the royal gatekeeper. It's like this role in The Wiz. And he's supposed to be snooty and sassy and bitchy. Or at least that's how I was directed. And there's a point where like we just kind of fill in blank space with me. At the time, some of the biggest songs were Britney. Britney was trying to have her comeback. So Womanizer was on the air, on the radio waves. Uh-huh. But also Single Ladies had just come out.
Okay.
So for this 3-week run at school, I mean, we were it was intense that we got that many performances. I was supposed to have a moment where I was like dusting the gate to Oz with a feather duster and like humming Womanizer to myself and then fully evolving into like a performance of Womanizer for myself. And then I see Dorothy coming back from like having just killed the Wicked Witch of the West and Evelina. But then on the last night, on closing night, I completely went off script or went off, you know, against direction and instead did Single Ladies. I did the Single Ladies dance.
Oh,
people ate it up. And then after closing...
You did the actual dance?
Yeah.
With the duster?
Yeah. And The director was not happy.
Why? If it killed.
Because I couldn't follow directions. I went like I went against his.
You went rogue.
Yeah, I went rogue. Talent. I went rogue. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so when I was up for Bernardo in senior year, they were like,
"We can't have Bernardo doing not... single ladies."
Well, that too. But he fully was. He sat me down. He was like, "I'm not taking you seriously for the role." I was like, "It was like one of the biggest kind of like shocks to me." And honestly, I think about it now as we're talking about this. It was one of those things where it made me okay. I'm gonna follow rules. I'm gonna follow rules. You know, even at that age at high school, like, you know, you're still so malleable and you learn so much. And
do you think that was a good lesson?
I mean, know when to follow rules, right, when it's worth it. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things where I really fully said, ask for forgiveness, not for permission.
Right.
And it's still a part of me that I still struggle with to this day, where it's like now as an adult. I mean, I think so. Danny and I, when we met at BuzzFeed ages ago.
Yeah.
You know, we were working in that office and we were there in 2016. I mean, do you remember that night? Were you in the office that night?
What night? 26. Oh, of course. Oh, God, I forgot.
We were all there.
Do you know what happened to me? They had asked me, they had prepped me because everybody thought Hillary was going to win. Yeah. And I vote in Florida because I'm famously from Miami. And my friend who was in politics was like, do you mind? Because we were doing a Twitter live party.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This
was
when
show.
Twitter live was a thing. And said, can we pull you aside at one point to talk about Florida because you vote in Florida. And I'm like, of course. I was wearing a fucking pantsuit, by the way. So anyway, I was like, sure. And then at one point in the middle, so my friend who was a political reporter had told me, we had lunch that day, and he told me, she's winning. Like, there's no way Trump is going to win. And I'm like, this man must know. He's been reporting on this for like a full year. So there was open bar, food, this whole thing. So I'm drinking wine. And at one point in the middle of the night, he comes up to me and he says, I would switch to hard liquor. And then I got wasted.
Yeah.
And at one point they were like, can we interview you? And I was like, I can't be on camera right now. I was like, I cannot be on camera. And I just remember leaving that night with this other girl who was a writer at BuzzFeed. Actually, I think she was my editor. I can't remember if it was her, but because we were neighbors and we weren't like that close. We were colleagues, but we're like not friends. And we're sharing an Uber together and she starts bawling. And I'm like, I don't know what to do. So I'm like, there. But it was a somber night. Just
it
to
was
kind
rough.
Of
rough. I was there as well. Like, I was watching.
Describe the atmosphere.
Yeah. Yes. So we were on like I wasn't on the international team yet with you actually at the time, maybe.
I was, I think, on the style team at that point.
Oh, you were the style.
That's when
okay.
we had
overlap.
Yeah. When we had closed down Espanol, I think.
Ah, okay.
And it had been moved to the style. I think so. I can't remember, but I think I was. Anyway.
I bring it up because I, you know, thinking about following rules, I think that was when I had another kind of culture shock that, you know, obviously my values align with like progressivism and we needed to like challenge authority, challenge, and particularly in my, I'll speak for myself, I had to start challenging my family on their political beliefs. Not that they're, I don't have to go into that, but you know, just kind of explain.
Don't get me started on that.
Yeah. I was just like,
that's another podcast.
Yeah, fully.
That's my entire life.
To explain why it's important to buck the rules and stand up for, you know, the rights of Black people, to stand up for the rights of queer people, of trans people, of immigrants, of undocumented immigrants. And, you know, being immigrants coming through the quote unquote correct avenues, it's like there is this kind of closing of the gates behind you. Like, I did it the right way. Everybody should.
Yeah.
And so, and I had to like tell my family, explain like that's messed up. Like that
of course
you people, these are human beings. Anyway, so I bring that up to say, I had to like unlearn rule following. I still continue to do that. I think it's so ingrained in me, like coming to America to like prove model minority-ism, to be the model minority, to be so excellent that they cannot question your place here.
I mean, you fit in this box, so you belong.
Exactly. Yeah. You're smart. You're Asian. Yeah. You make sense to us. Awesome. So I have to keep playing that role. Mm-hmm. You know, I played roles on stage and off, and it continues to be a big part of me to like remind myself: am I going to follow this rule? Like, am I going to go with the flow, or am I going to pick a fight? Am I going to stand up for what I believe in?
Wow.
Even if it means you know, ruffling feathers in my family, in my community, in my workplace, etc.
That's so interesting. Super interesting
for sure. Also, like, yeah, to have it tied into, it makes so much sense. Have it tied into like wanting to be a model, wanting to under, like wanting to really.
Well, you want to be, when you're like an immigrant, you want to be accepted.
Yeah.
So it's like, especially when you're a kid, you're like, I just want to be like Haley or whatever, this girl that's like fully American. Dying.
we all know exactly who we picture.
First American friend, her name was Madison. And I was like, I just want to be like Madison.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, why am I not like, I remember even hating my name. I'm like, Daniela sounds like not American. And sometimes I would like, when people ask me my name, I would say Danielle.
Danielle.
Because when I would say Daniela, they would be like, what?
So interesting. Can I ask, like, okay, so when you talk about the rule following, I'm not an immigrant, but like thinking about taking myself out of my own context has helped me shift up what I feel like I'm allowed to be in the world. So moving here has really helped me be like, okay, I thought I had to behave this one very specific way because I was always in that one specific context. And it's really shaken up how I don't know, like how liberal I feel with my identity.
How is
travel for you? I don't want to lead you, but like, has it impacted the flexibility you feel like with who you are, how you can behave?
Yes. I like that word, flexibility. I think something that I'm really trying to interrogate in my own kind of thinking, and something that I like to write about a lot more, it's something that's going to be a part of like one of my next books, I think, is this sense of when I travel, I'm always wondering how the locals read me. So for example, here in Paris, do they read me first as American or as something else? Because they'll look at me and they're not exactly sure what they see. I mean, Paris is a very diverse city, you know, huge Asian immigration population. We actually did a wonderful feature in Condé Nast Traveler. Our December 2023 issue is our all Asia issue. But to talk about Paris, we talked about the Asian influence of Paris in Paris. So Asian creatives and chefs like really making a mark and bringing their diaspora techniques and heritage and storytelling into food, into art, into culture. And it was written by the wonderful R.O. Kwan, the Korean-American author. And it was a really, really great piece. But in reading that, I was thinking a lot about, too, how we are read in a place like Europe. Are we seen first as Asian? Are we seen first as American? Are we seen, when they look at me, do they know what they're looking at or talking to? And what I try to do is, so I'm obviously trying to practice my French, and more, the more that I visit, I feel more confident in it. But whenever I'm in a position where I'm like, I'm just like tired, like it takes extra brain power, especially learning like a third or a fourth language. Yeah. As an adult. So for example, when I check in, I'll be like, hi, good morning. What was that accent? I'd be like, hi, good morning. Bonjour, ça va? Et voilà. J'ai une réservation. Il s'appelle ma tortille. Oh, thank you so much. I have to like throw in my American accent and like try my best with the French at the same time. Yeah, so it's like, please know that I'm still learning.
Right.
But I really want to practice with you. And like, I'm trying to like, you know, I'm not trying to make you speak as much English as you should have to. Uh-huh. But then sometimes they'll keep going and going. And I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, no. Like, I gave you the wrong impression.
Si possible, en anglais. Voilà.
Do they ever ask you that question? Vous viendez où? Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was part of why I'm here. I'm here, obviously, to see my wonderful friends. But also, I've been in the country for a little over a week because I've been working on a story. I was in the Chartreuse Mountains in southeastern France, in a town called Voiron, not far from Lyon. And because I don't drive, my mom never let me drive. I had to Uber to a museum in the middle of nowhere. It's the museum, the Musée de la Grande Chartreuse. It's the museum of the monks, the
Chartreusean monks. That's so cool.
It's really lovely. And they show you how the order was founded and the lives that they lead, which is actually much more modern and like contemporary than I thought. You know, they're like an adaptive, I guess, kind of sect that they don't forego the conveniences of modern life. But anyway, so on the way back, I had to call another Uber. Oh my God, it was the most expensive museum visit I've ever had. bad.
Oh no.
But you know, I think, but I bring it up to say the driver was, saw me like, ah, vous êtes mat, voilà. I was like, oui, c'est moi. Ça va? So we had a little bit of a chat. It was fine. I didn't mind the Uber chatting because I try to practice. And then
it is true. It's free French lessons.
He said, exactly. It's free French lessons. And then sometimes they really are like, ah, no, the word is feminine. So là, pas le, c'est là.
Oh, they love a moment to correct
you. Oh, yeah. No, it's true. I'm like, I'll just take it. You know?
That's their love language, to correct people.
Oh, yeah. That means they care enough to like help you improve. It's true. So, and then he did ask me, tu viens d'où? Yeah, and so, ah, okay, oui, je suis de New York, mais je suis né à Manille, je suis Filipino, voilà. So it's interesting. And then I, funnily enough, I start to think that way too. I was looking at him and I was like, he seems brown.
Right.
I didn't bother asking. I was like, I didn't want to be so invasive.
Right.
But I was like, oh, he's probably some kind of like mix or like probably from an immigrant family, diaspora, like Mediterraneans, you know, like could be North African, something. And so I did kind of think about that, and it makes me wonder, in Europe, it doesn't feel as racist to me, even though I know a lot of people will feel like, no, shut up, that it's racist sometimes.
Yeah.
But sometimes it comes to me, those interactions, I truly genuinely write off as plain curiosity.
I was going to say that. To me, it also feels like they're actually curious and they want to hear where you're from and... And again, of course, there is racism. I'm not saying there isn't. But when they ask me, because I get asked that question, we're just talking about this offline, because our names could be very ambiguous. Like, you can't really tell where we're from when you read our names. So, and when I speak French, I have a Spanish accent. Mm. So when they ask me, like, where are you from? I think it's more like curiosity is like, this is so interesting. You speak French, but you have an accent. And like, you look white, but you're not like white, you know? You know? So to me, and actually the place I got my nails done, the lady, I think she is Vietnamese.
Oh, well.
She was doing my nails and she goes, are you Asian?
She straight up
goes, are you Asian? And I was like, no. She's like, you look Asian. I was like, yeah, I get that a lot. And so to me, I think we could look a way where they're like, I know, like, you look different. Like, where are you from? But it's not coming from a, I don't like it. It's coming from like, this is so interesting. Where are you from? Why do you have an accent?
It's genuinely novel to them. And what's funny is like, I get it a lot. I get it. So obviously in America, I mean, one of my first sort of like big kind of culture shocks was like not being someone looking at me and not knowing what they see again. So it's actually now for me a point of fascination. But as a kid, I was always very kind of appalled by it. I remember, you know, because I was gay as a kid. Now I'm straight. No. I, you know, I've always been gay. But when I was starting to come out.
How young?
I came out at 13.
Wow,
it's pretty young. And I just kind of like, there's no use in denying it.
Right,
like, it's
so
obvious. Wow. I was like, I'm not going to lie and like waste my energy. I'm like, yeah, I'm a F word. And like kind of like throwing the words that they would throw at me back at them.
Right. Jeez.
So at a certain point, it got boring to them. So my bully stopped bullying me. And then at one point, a friend of mine was like, oh, blah, 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 blah. We were talking about something. Because you're Puerto Rican. I'm like, what? No, I'm not. I'm Filipino. What? No, I'm not. I'm Filipino. You know? And so always Americans have had a very hard time reading me facially, identifying me. Because like maybe I don't, if they've met a Filipino in their lives, I don't look like them. Because then even now as I, when I go back to the Philippines, people actually ask me like, oh, are you Filipino? Like they're surprised.
Yeah.
When I meet Filipinos abroad, when I suddenly speak to them in Tagalog, they're like, they're shocked. Because they didn't expect.
Why do you think that is?
So I actually don't have typical Filipino features.
Okay.
Like whenever I'm home actually, so when I pull up Grindr, you know, gay hookup app, guys are actually in the Philippines will ask me, oh, where are you from? Where are you from? And I'm like, I'm from here.
Where do they normally think you're from?
They often think I'm mixed.
Okay.
Which means then for them that there is, that you're plus something else.
Right. You're not like fully Filipino. There's
fully
something
Filipino.
Else. Okay.
Which then sometimes puts me at a distance from them. But then once they get to know me and like they fully realize I'm culturally Filipino, like, or at least I have, well, culturally Filipino from the 90s. Like my slang from when I'm in Tagalog is still from the 90s and the early aughts. And so it's, I've kind of been accustomed now in these ways to always feel like, you know what, I'm not going to fit in.
Right.
So at a certain point, I think travel helped me figure this out, yeah. I think, for me. Wherever I go, at this point, I have to like let go of the desire to blend in, right. to like not be seen or to be a part of the majority culture, mm-hmm. because that's just not going to happen.
Right.
Like one day I'd like to live in Paris, but I think a lot about how would I ever consider myself French at a certain right. point? Like I could live here 15 years and I wonder, will I ever say I'm French? Mm. If maybe with a passport, something. But even now, I've lived in New York for 11 years. I've lived in America for most of my life. So 11 plus 7. I've lived in America for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Actually more than. And so it makes me wonder, you know, not wonder. It's actually, I've kind of resigned myself. I was thinking about this. Someone described to me in French, they were like having a hard time to find the right word in English. They were like, you know, résigné. Résigné. I was like, oh, resign.
Resign,
yeah. Kind of, you've given yourself up to it. You're like, you know what? Fine.
Which is so liberating because I kind of feel freeing. The same way. Like for a long time, I was like in between. I'm like, am I Venezuelan? Am I American? Mm. And now I'm like, but you know what? I've never felt French. And not like in a like this or anything, but it's just like, I'm like, and I'm curious how you describe yourself or like present yourself. When people are like, where are you from? Mm. What do you say? I now say I'm American because culturally I'm very American. That's where I spent the majority of my life. I am a quarter American. My grandfather was American. So I consider myself American in many ways. I don't say I'm Venezuelan because then it's like, I haven't been there in so long. I don't really have many, I only have one family member left there. So I just like, I feel culturally very Venezuelan in my childhood and like the foods that I like and the things that I remember. But I feel American in many ways, especially when I'm in France, in the French context.
Yes, yes.
And when people put me in a box, they're like, you fucking American. They're never like, you fucking Venezuelan. But and I think that was very liberating for me too. It was like, yes. I don't want to be French. I'm going to be who I am.
Yeah.
I'm going to obviously try to like assimilate as much as I can and be in their culture and integrate. In a respectful way.
Integrate is the word I hear a lot.
Yes. Yeah. But I am not going to claim to be French. And maybe that'll change if I'm here for another 5 years. But right now I'm like, you know what I say? I'm from New York.
I was going to say, that was going to be my chip to throw in. Yeah. I say, when they ask me, where are you from? Je suis de New York. And they so, even New Yorkers will be like, I'm not an American. I'm a New Yorker.
Yeah, it's true.
Because there is such a cultural difference. Because
you could be anything in New York.
100%. Because
when you say from New York, you're American, but you're like a different kind of American.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I'm sure like, because it has such a big immigration.
Everyone comes from somewhere else. Yes. Which is, it's interesting. I mean, this is a complete side tangent, but there's a lot of like, on TikTok, a lot of energy from native New Yorkers where it's like, no, you'll never be a New Yorker. that's my awful New York accent impression. But then I saw a counterpoint to that. If the most interesting thing about you is that you're from New York, you're not a real New Yorker.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's interesting.
I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
And that's a fight that you guys have. I don't have no skin in that game.
And I think it's a good transition to ask you about college.
Please,
you went to school in New York, right?
College. Yeah, in the Hudson Valley, 2 hours north of the city. But yeah, I was close to the city.
Right, but I feel like that when you'll tell me how you felt when you moved to New York, and Gabby, we've discussed this in the pot before, but I grew up in Miami, and you said you didn't like growing up in Vegas.
Yeah.
I felt the same way about Miami. I kind of felt like there has to be more to life than
100%.
This. 100%. And when I moved to New York, it was the first time in my life where I was like, this is where I belong. Like,
yes.
I should be here forever. Uh-huh. This is my people. This is my vibe. Like, I love the neighborhood. I love the energy. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I'm curious if like when you moved from Vegas to New York, even if you were in the Hudson Valley, I'm assuming you would come to the city often.
Absolutely. Yeah. As much as I could.
That's when you were like, this is what it's all about.
100%.
The fake Venice in Vegas is not it. It's not cutting it. And this is like.
Vegas isn't it. This is the real New York skyline.
New York in.
New York, New York hotel.
What is happening in that place?
Oh, it's been there for ages. So the hotel is shaped. The hotel building is shaped like the New York skyline. And outside, because again, the city is Disneyland. You know, there must be more than this provincial life. Is how I felt.
I mean, as someone who grew up going to Epcot, and this way, because I lived in Miami, I would go to Orlando every vacation.
Yeah.
Well, I was a kid, so I enjoyed it. But as I got older, I was like, this feels fake. Like you said, I'm like, where's the real deal? Where's the real culture?
For us, like the roller coaster was this roller coaster in New York, New York hotel outside of the building. And the cars, the like roller coaster kind of things that you ride in, are made to look like New York yellow cabs.
Taxis. Yeah,
yeah, yellow
taxis. That's kind of cute.
Does everyone just scream "fuck you" like the end? Like, in the,
I wish. I'm walking here.
Yeah, I'm walking here. Out of the way. So okay. So what was the transition like from Vegas to New York? Even New if York it was City, the Hudson Valley.
Yeah.
And also, like, talk about your college, because it is known as a very like liberal school, right?
Yeah. Vassar. I went to Vassar College. I was there from 2010 to 2014, and it's a big part of my identity, actually. Being from Vassar was like so integral to me learning that I could be a part of something American. I could be part of an American institution. I mean, this is an old school. It's like 250 years old. It started out as a women's college. It became co-ed in 1969 when they refused to merge with Yale. So I'm proudly a Seven Sister. For me, I always joked that I was so integrated into like campus life and college life. I was so about Vassar. I was like in the promo brochures. Like I was on the college website front page like multiple times. Like the school photographer knew who I was. Like I was, again, this model minority.
Okay.
Is the thing, right? Like they
were
like,
love to do the blended. Like, the images I feel like for the college were always like, because I used to do the college stuff modeling too. Sure. And I was like the one white girl, and then there were like
And then like the black dude, and then the Latina girl. Yeah,
every single time.
And so they like loved having this like nerdy queer brown boy be like so Vassar, like done up in like New England prep. Like I was wearing like Ralph Lauren from the outlet mall, you know, like I was playing my
I
want to
see some of these images.
Oh,
do you have them?
Oh yeah.
Matt was also the person that would give you the orientation tour at BuzzFeed.
I didn't carry that over.
Yeah.
I was that energy.
The first person I met at BuzzFeed was Matt.
Yeah.
Wow, you really are.
For my first 2 years, I was this, you know, glorified assistant role, but it was called Education and Culture Coordinator. But BuzzFeed was growing so fast. I think we had an average.
You were doing tours like twice a week.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would, you know, get to know everybody and be like, take the new hairs around the newsroom, and like this is, you know, the
I guess that's
desk.
A performance
this
in its own
politics. It is
true that Matt was the one person that, because BuzzFeed, like he said, it was growing so quickly, so it was very overwhelming, but everybody knew Matt because that was the first person you met, and he was so like welcoming and warm.
So you were BuzzFeed.
It made it it made it less intimidating, because you walk into this like room full of hipsters and you're just like, okay, what am I, like, what's happening here, you know? And, like, the conference room is called, like, Beyonce or whatever the fuck.
Yeah.
And so you're just like,
is this... We have a meeting in Beyonce.
Yes, like, Taylor Swift and Five.
Yeah. That is wild.
But, again, you know, there is that sense of performance. There is that sense of, like, being so... drinking the Kool-Aid. I think that's another big theme for me in terms of, like, acclimating to cultures and reducing that sense of culture shock.
Do you actually... When you say drink the Kool-Aid, like you really feel like in your bones, like you're like, I'm part of this. That's so interesting.
Like, you know, again, like I was so part of Vassar. Like I said that like I was, I'm from Vassar. Like I was like.
But wait, so when you were at Vassar, did you feel that you immediately fit in, or did you feel that there was any kind of like culture shocks? Like you mentioned, maybe like the being more aware of the, like, did anyone ever question your identity at any point, or you question your identity?
I immediately felt like I fit in. Because I was high achieving, and that was a school of high achievers. Culturally, I think what a lot of people started to do in our first year was start to shed their own youth identity. What I wrote it in the book as they were starting to shed their Connecticut skins and declaring themselves Buddhists.
Yeah.
You know, like these white kids from Greenwich being like, actually, I don't want my parents' money. Like, I'm going to look like... You know,
so everybody was sort of starting fresh.
It was starting fresh, and like you know that energy of like the rich kid who's like dressed in all thrifted stuff, but like actually they have a trust fund.
They're paid for sure.
It's very that energy. That's the predominant culture. But I think overall there was this thing that united us about, and my year in particular, like my batch of classmates, like my class was like really into it. Like the Facebook group was popping before we ever got in on move-in day.
Oh, that's cool.
Everyone was
fun, though.
So
you had
excited
like community before you moved there.
Exactly. I had friends already immediately, so it was not a huge shock. But I think eventually what started to come was that, oh yeah, white old institutions can be really fucked up. Are really fucked up. I mean, like we see what's happening now. You know, at like universities everywhere. I'm not going to name names, but you know. Yeah. It's it was really interesting. And then moving on to BuzzFeed, drinking that Kool-Aid, it was so part of our identities. I mean, you remember this.
Yeah, it's like a cult.
You were a BuzzFeed girl. You were a BuzzFeed boy. But it was
like, and it's like when I talked about this in an earlier episode, but the BuzzFeed thing was interesting because when I got laid off, you lose a little bit of your identity.
You
so you're just like, who am I now? But so
it
definitely was like it was a cool thing in the golden age of BuzzFeed. It was like you worked at BuzzFeed. They're like, you're the coolest person on earth. Yeah. I mean, you know how it's a Gen Z like nostalgia
now,
thing.
They're like, I wish I was born. I know y'all were in the trenches, but I'm so sorry. All I want to be is millennial posting on Tumblr. Like, and I'm like, yeah. It was kind of fun.
I saw a TikTok like what I would wear if I had a shift at BuzzFeed. Like a shift.
And I knew exactly who these people were.
I was like,
that's what I'm wondering.
That's so.
But anyway, I know we have to wrap up because you have a lunch. So the last thing.
So
who is Matt now? Like, you're in New York now, but you're traveling all over the world. Like, where do you see yourself? Like, your identity and like culturally, like, do you still find these culture shocks and culture clashes when you're traveling? And also, I mean, you're a frequent visitor to Paris.
Yeah.
And you mentioned you love coming here.
Yeah, I'd love to live here someday. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, where do you see yourself?
It's interesting. There is this growing sense when I talk to my New York friends about this, that there's just New York is deeply, deeply changing and it's getting incredibly expensive. And I think in the 2010s, you know, when we were in BuzzFeed era, like there was this sense that you could really make it work, that you could have a really full life, making a certain amount of money. But now everything is just getting so honestly expensive. The rent is too damn high. And, you know, we have an amazing person running for mayor right now who, you know, is running on a platform of just like really making New York livable again. And it feels, someone said this to me, the juice doesn't feel like it's worth the squeeze anymore.
Yeah, and I feel like it's driven away a lot of interesting creative people.
Absolutely.
And people who could affect culture.
There's this wonderful New York Magazine cover story. It must be nice to be a West Village girl. Have you guys seen this?
Yes,
oh my God,
of course.
Have we seen it?
It's so, so, it. So good. Like, but it essentially talks about just how like there is this like class of like white woman and also just like white people in general, actually, like going into these what were once really creative enclaves of New York, like these are places with history of like, you know, queer history that is just getting so honestly colonized. It's even worse than gentrified, actually. I think it's just like it's erasing a lot of the culture. And I don't know. I mean, please read the story. It's wonderful in New York Magazine. But I think now for me to answer your original question, Danny, about who I am now, I think thinking back again to what we were talking about how do we identify anymore? To your point, I appreciate the identifying as an American, because I think for me, when I identify as American, I say it to own the privilege that I have as an American person, the fact that I carry a blue passport, that I have when I'm at the airport and you see those lines at immigration and customs where all other passports here, but Canada, US, South Korea, Israel, like go on this line.
VIP.
It's VIP. It's faster. At CDG, that's how it is.
Yeah.
Right. And then all EU passports here and then everybody else over there. And like that line is the longest.
Yeah.
So when I say I'm American, I try to own that, even though now, especially in 2025, when you're saying you're American, you're either met with either disgust or pity.
Yeah, true.
Or sometimes jealousy still. Like I think
it's a weird mix of all of it. And I find that to be one of the most confusing. And they don't even know what they're feeling.
Yeah, it's an interesting cocktail of emotions, because I've been learning a lot about, for example, culture in France and just the social protections that are in place makes me think, oh, it's so much better in France. But then people will tell me like, well, you know why people from France or from Europe move to America. There's social mobility in America. There's class mobility in America. You make more money. Like if you work, there is still this sense of like, if you work hard, you will succeed.
Oh, 100%.
The American dream.
Yeah. Yeah. Like American dream.
Yeah.
Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And it's an interesting thing because there's kernels of truth in all of it.
Right.
But like, France is not a utopia. Like when I talk to like my black friends here or like black friends who visit, they experience deep levels of like racism, or like friends in London, friends in the UK. It's like there's, I mean, it's like such a trite thing to say, but there's good and bad in everything.
Well, no, yeah. But it's true. And I think, and people tend to romanticize living in France. It is, yes. And then until you move here, especially when you're an immigrant here, they're not very easily accepting unless you check, you're part of that box. Boxes. You fit in this box and they're like, okay, well, you're going to do everything we say. So you're one of us.
Yeah.
But if you're going to not do everything we say, then we're going to make your life hell.
Yeah.
So yeah, definitely think that's the case in France for sure. Yeah. But so do you feel, because of everything that's going on in New York, that you're maybe gravitating towards like potentially wanting to live in Europe because you feel like the culture is being affected in what was once a very cultural and fun city?
For me, I like New York was always going to be endgame. Okay. Like, I was like New York through and through. I remember, again, in the book, one particular chapter is about coming to New York and how as a kid I had like imprinted, you know, on Sex and the City, Will and Grace, The Nanny, like New York.
Media did give New York.
Media like fucked me up.
Yeah.
Yeah, but also did so much for New York ever since. You know, for some people, it's like, oh, The Sopranos are, I don't know that it really did that. Or like Friends. I wasn't a Friends watcher, but
you had a Carrie Bradshaw thing, right?
I was a very Carrie Bradshaw. Yeah. I always said, Matt or Tele is if Carrie Bradshaw and the French philosopher Roland Barthes had a baby and the baby was on Grindr. Like,
oh my God.
Stupid. Like, whatever. That was used to be my intro obsessed. Before I had a book.
No, but even when you're described online, it'll like mention Carrie Bradshaw.
Yeah. I think that's kind of like one of those things that I had because I was always interested in writing about like dating in the city.
Yeah,
like,
it makes
what
sense.
It meant to be single and like how to find a sense of self outside of a relationship because so much of my upbringing, I thought I needed a relationship to save me. Like I thought marriage would save me. I thought marriage to a white man would save me. It would make me American. Would make me feel rooted in this place. But again, like New York felt so endgame. And so now to be confronted with the possibility like, oh shit, it might not be. Right. It's pushing me out. Like I can't enjoy my rent every night because I can't afford to go out. Yeah. Like now when I date, I'm like, honestly, look, can we get a bottle of wine and we can drink at your place or mine? Right. Like, I can't spend another $20 on a cocktail before tip.
And also $20 on a glass of wine.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Insane in New York at this
And I'm like,
point.
A bottle? Yeah. Like, you know, I'd rather do that. But so I think now the possibility of like, I've had to like reopen myself up to the possibility that New York is not end all be all, that America is not end all be all. Mm-hmm. For so much of my life, as a Filipino person, because we were colonized as well by America. We were colonized by the Spanish, the Japanese very briefly, and by America. And so to kind of be told all my life, America is where you're going to end up.
Right.
And now to like really look at it in the face and be like, actually, maybe this isn't it. Maybe it's going back to the Philippines. Maybe it's moving to Europe. Maybe it's completely somewhere else. I have a friend who just like, got her Canadian citizenship, like a Canadian passport. She's always been a citizen because of her mother. But she texted me and she was like, I got into Canada. Like it was like a college exception, like acceptance. She was like, great. Like you got early decision in Canada. Like, do they have financial aid? I think they do. Yeah. And so to like really look at that in the face and really mull that question over, how much longer am I going to be here for?
Right.
It's tough because there's things that were really, really keeping me there. I love my job. I love my friends who are there, but even they're looking to move, whether outside of the country or even just outside of the city.
Yeah.
It's an interesting time right now, I think, to be an American generally, because if you're someone who's just even paying attention at all to the news, you're like, oh, this society is falling apart. And I don't want to like dwell on that too much, but I did see a headline. It was like a New York Times opinion. I need to read it. An opinion piece. It said, we study fascism and we are leaving America.
Ugh.
I was like, oh God.
Yeah.
But beyond that, I think to end it on a more like positive note, I think there are these things that are making any one of us, I think we all, like you guys have had your reasons for leaving. I have my reasons for thinking about leaving. But also there are reasons to go somewhere.
True.
To be excited about the thing that you're heading towards.
Rather than running away.
Yeah.
Than escaping, rather than finding a lifeboat.
Yeah.
I think that's what I've had to like tell myself like the possibility of moving. There's a chapter of my life in a particular place where I can feel myself growing again. Mm-hmm. Where I can feel myself kind of filling out my outline, kind of really learning new things. Because I think at any given time, you're gonna, whether it's because of place, of job, relationship, you're gonna feel like the limits of that box. Again, boxes that we check. And then you're like, okay, is it time for a change? Some people don't love change. Some people really do. And I think for me, I'm someone who leans on consistency. So change really, really scares me. But I think for the first time, I'm really realizing there are things that are different and that I have not yet experienced that make me really stoked. Mm. So I rather than escape, I'd really love pursuit.
That's great.
And I think that's also why I travel, to pursue the new and unfamiliar to me so that I can learn more about myself and the world around me.
I love that. That's a great ending note.
All right. We are very close to that time and we don't want to make Matt late. So, but I do want to know, I think this. You have a prepared, how do I not know this?
I do.
How do you not know this? I forgot the name
how
of
do
our
we
segment.
Not know this?
How do you not know this?
Yeah. Okay. So drum roll, let's go.
Huh? How do you not know about Chartreuse? Oh my God. So I'm in France reporting a story about Chartreuse. There's a shortage in America because the monks are making less. Chartreuse is a liqueur that comes from France that is made by Carthusian monks. It is from a manuscript dated 1607.
Oh my God, you're an encyclopedia. This
fully,
is insane.
It's like a formula of 130 botanicals that was given to the monks by one of the Marquis des Entrées, I think is who it is. But or a chancellor or something, like some very fancy aristocrat who came into this manuscript, gave it to the monks. And then the monks worked on it until like the 1700s, like 1760 something. And then they finally landed on a formula for an elixir vegetal, like an herbal elixir that is meant to like really help you with thick sicknesses. So
wait, I didn't know that.
It's supposed to help.
So it was initially like a medicine.
It was originally a medicine. It was a medicinal tonic. And then they also developed the formula that we now know today, which is this green chartreuse. Mm-hmm. And then they also developed yellow chartreuse, and which is more honeyed and rounded in flavor, a little bit more on the sweet side. The yellow chartreuse, you can tell by the legs around the glass, like how like it's a little bit, it looks a little bit more syrupy. But yellow is a little weaker. It's at but it's by no means, you know, a light drink. It's like 49% ABV. And then Chartreuse green is I think 57 or 56. And then the elixir, which is like the medicinal thing that you have to like absolutely mix with something else, it's at like 67.
Wow.
Or no. Even maybe closer up to like 70 or something.
Whoa.
It's quite high. I might be mixing up my percentages, but please
we'll forgive
fact
you.
Check me. Yeah. But it's really fascinating stuff. It's like I like to describe it as if like a grass green valley just slapped you in the face. It is such an interesting flavor. A lot of people nowadays mix it in cocktails. There's an IBA cocktail called The Last Word that was made in the 20th century in the United States that really kind of popularized chartreuse in the country. But then now, more recently, ever since COVID, people became at-home mixologists. People got hip to chartreuse before. It was just something that a lot of restaurant workers would drink at the end of the shift because nobody would drink it, and it was very, very strong. So it kind of became like an in-drink to know. And then suddenly more and more people outside of the industry who are just like making drinks at home because there's nothing to do in the pandemic, they start to buy more of it. And then so demand all over the world increased, particularly in Western countries. And then it came out in 2023. It turns out in that year that they had discovered a letter dated 2021 from Chartreuse Diffusion, which is the business arm of the monks, and they said essentially, look, we know that there's a lot of demand. We're not going to increase supply. Actually, we're going to limit it. Ooh. Because, one, we are monks. Our God is not capitalism. That's a very different God, just so you know. And two, they essentially said it's not sustainable. If they were to make more, this is a recipe of 130 botanicals. 50%, I learned, come from France. The other 50% are from all over the world.
Okay.
And so to increase more would be to possibly deplete that natural supply that nature would not be able to renew
to keep up with. Yeah,
exactly. Like be able to supply the raw ingredients to demand, like to fulfill consumer demand. And so they were like, look, we want to pray. Leave us alone. Like we think there are two. Two monks.
Talk about the recipe.
Yes, the recipe. There are two monks who know the full recipe. They're two fathers, Carthusian fathers. They never travel together because if they were to get into an accident, the formula would be lost to time.
This is insane. Do they have security guards or something?
Possibly.
Is there like a safe with the recipe just in case?
It's only transmitted orally.
Are you serious?
Yes.
What if you forget? What if one of them is like,
I know.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I forgot how much, I don't know,
like
mint I put.
X amount of yeah. whatever. Yeah. But what's really just really fascinating to me is that there is this cool heritage product that's kind of shrouded in mystery, that a little bit of mystique. And then I went to the Musée de la Grande Chartreuse, which is closer to the monastery, and it shows you about the monastic life. That's where I learned a lot of this too. And it is just such a beautiful place. And it almost, to me, represent, even though only 50% of the ingredients are from around France, it just kind of made sense that this extremely herbal, very literally green, it's so green and iconic that it gave its name to that color, Chartreuse, that's where it comes from. It was just so, felt so connected to the place, and it felt like I was drinking that part of the valley.
Oh, that's cool.
You know, it's stunning. And I think that that's part of why I love, so at Traveler, one of my beats is wine and spirits. So obviously in France, there's this concept of terroir and, you know, that the place is inextricably linked to the taste of the thing, whether it's wine or cheese or whatever. And it felt so clear and like, obviously the environment has an impact on the thing that is produced, but also something I've been thinking about for the article is that how is this kind of mystery and exclusivity and limited production kind of shape the experience that you have when you drink it?
Because it makes it feel special.
It makes it feel special.
You can't get this any, like, or you, there's only a limited supply of this.
So exactly.
When you're drinking it, you're like, wow.
What's wild. So I got to interview the mayor of Varron, and it was my very first interview entirely in French.
Wow.
So
insane.
That's crazy. I wouldn't even do that.
I was so scared, but he was so lovely. He said something really interesting because I was like, décrivez pour moi la relation entre les Varron et le Chartreuse. And so he said something like, for Varonnet, Chartreuse is like Proust's Madeleine. It's about, when you taste it, it's about home. It's about nostalgia and memory. It's something they grew up with, and it's inextricably linked to where they're from and who they are as a person. And so for a small set of like French people, like Chartreuse is a part of their life. Mm-hmm. For like, you know, cocktail fans in Australia or in the UK or in America, it's this exclusive thing, mysterious, but for someone, it's just, it's like my grandma's drink.
Right.
You know, and like, Paul just had the bottle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
With his family, like, Paul, they unearthed from, like,
we gotta post this photo of that.
Like, yeah, we'll post a photo of it. They found that in his grandmother's house. It's like from the 1969.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And it's, yeah, yeah. Wow. It's a very, yeah, you're right. It's so interesting how these, like, spirits or cheeses or whatever they're from, like, they just really, for us, they can represent, like, oh, that's so cool. Like, I want to taste this liqueur that's made by two monks that can't travel together, you know? Yeah. But for someone from there, it's probably like, this represents my home.
The most ordinary thing.
Which makes it more special. Like, the fact that it's like a quotidian stuff. Thing for someone.
And that kind of difference in culture, that difference in context, that difference in understanding to the product is really, really fascinating to me. And I'm not totally sure if that's something that's interesting to other people. So that's why I was like, what's my, how do you not know this? I'm like, well, of course, they may or may not know about this. I'm just being a huge nerd about it.
I knew very little honestly. Yeah. All I knew is that there's a shortage.
Yeah.
And it's hard to find.
Yeah.
That's all I knew
so
about
it. So
got
good PR for it. Matt, we're so excited to read this article.
Thank you so much.
So excited to see how
thank
you frame
you for
it.
Being on today.
Oh, thank you so much for
telling us
being on.
Everything about yourself.
Thank you so much. I love Clashists. And I'm really, really honored to be here. Thank you so much for having
me.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye, guys. This was Clashists.
Podcast brought to you by two idiots.
Clearly. I don't know if I can laugh on cue.